Hello and welcome to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers.
And me, Alex Rouget.
And our studio guest today, Tim Dee. We've got interviews with Anne Shannon, who's the manager at the Jane Austen House Museum in Hampshire, and also with Alex Mellenby, whose first novel, Tregartha's Promise, a teen fiction novel, is just out. So, Alex, in terms of landscape writing, because that's what Tim is, a landscape writer, we'll see if that's how he describes himself later. What's your favourite bit of landscape writing?
Well, I once again scoured the shelves and I came up with Tove Jansson. So, The Summer Book is such
a
beautiful, beautiful book. And I think just flicking through it again, it is just this combination of this kind of really unusual relationship between the grandmother and the child. And the relationship itself is so strange. And the landscape is both strange and familiar because I was brought up on an island, not a tiny little island in Scandinavia. More's the pity, but in Jersey. And she talks about looking out on the horizon and that sort of feeling of being on an island. And it really resonates with me. And I think that's what I look for in landscape writing is I like, and I also like Roger Deakin, Waterlog and that kind of thing. And I think I like things that are familiar. I haven't read a lot about places that I haven't really been to or things that don't sort of really, you know, have a connection to me.
Well, I'm going to go for the obvious. I'm going to go for Thomas Hardy and The Return of the Native in particular, which the opening of which just struck a particular chord with me. He's like a filmmaker, Hardy, the way he shows you the landscape and then zooms in. And The Return of the Native starts with Diggory Venn, who's a Reddle man, walking across the valley. And what a Reddle man does is he sells dyes, so he's constantly dyed red himself. So you have this amazing rolling landscape and then you zoom in to the path across the valleys and the red face of Diggory Venn. And really, in that opening section, you've got everything that's in the novel. A person deciding their own path in life, their own fate, but they're on a path, can they get off it, surrounded by this landscape that marks them. So I think that's just a fantastic piece of writing. Tim, I know you've read lots of landscape writing because your book, Four Fields, is full of it. What's your favourite piece?
Well, it's always hard to say. I'm a birdwatcher. I've been a birdwatcher since I was tiny. Really, my way into landscape or into writing was through birds. So my first requirement in that case was to find out, you know, to work out what I was looking at. So a kind of simple field guide. Seems to me now like a kind of poem, you know, a lovely list of names and plates of birds and things like that. And not long after I first encountered, got to grips with the kind of ordinary birds in the back garden, I also started reading as a child the poetry of Ted Hughes. And it was wonderful to discover a writer then who obviously had a pair of binoculars, who was looking hard at things in the same way that the field guide was encouraging you to look hard, you know, in order to separate your blue tit from your grey tit, from your coal tit, from your marsh tit, you had to really stare. And Ted Hughes's poems, although he seemed to be staring with quite a severe, bloodied eye for me, but nonetheless they were evidence of someone who'd really looked closely at things, had separated things, who loved naming, which I think is very important. It's not just a question of being out there and being swept away by the kind of great wildness of it all. I think actually the more we know, the more we know. And Hughes, so that funny combination of a sort of dry academic, if you like, field guide, plates, descriptions, birds' names, with this lysergic energy of a poet like Hughes coming in, mixing it all up, suggesting that there was a life beyond the song thrush that I was watching on the lawn. I didn't quite buy his version of a song thrush. It seemed to be rather terrifying. But nonetheless, it was exciting to think of a poet who was looking hard.
Yeah, he was very visceral, Hughes, wasn't he? I mean, you really got nature red in tooth and claw with him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I mean by not buying his version necessarily. But I love the idea that he was struggling with kind of bringing things that weren't him, you know, the world outside, into some sort of reality for himself. Seems to me that's the job of writers. It's the job of poets, particularly. That's a poet. A poet makes a good poem by looking hard at things that have got nothing to do with him or herself.
Well, we'll come back and give you a proper introduction in a moment. But we're going to listen to a piece of music that you've chosen first, and this is
King Tubby.
Why did you choose this?
Well, I love dub, it's just a fantastically cheerful sound to me. I love the idea of people taking one bit of sound, one bit of experience, one bit of lyric and sampling it, changing it around, moving it into a different place. It just seems to speak to me of a kind of... it's irresistible dance music as well, but it speaks to me of a kind of... of a wide world, which I really get excited about.
Through a valley with a princess by my side. Alice was there in Wonderland, staring far away. About Alibaba with the 40
Welcome back to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with our studio guest, Tim Dee. Tim is a writer, radio producer and birdwatcher. His acclaimed first book, The Running Sky, was published in 2009 and describes his first five birdwatching decades. He also worked with Simon Armitage on an anthology, The Poetry of Birds. His latest book, Four Fields, was described in The Guardian as an enthralling and unexpected book. The Independent said, Tim Dee is incapable of writing a dull sentence. Tim, could you just describe to us what Four Fields is about?
Well, it does what it says on the tin. it is about four fields. The principal field is a field in the Cambridgeshire Fens, just north of where we're talking today. The other three are foreign fields. The reason why fields is perhaps a bigger question, more important to me in some ways than those specific fields, although the specific four have got particular stories to tell. Fields, for me, because I grew up in southern England, I was a birdwatcher, as I mentioned, from an early age, wanted to be outside all the time. And outside, for me, fundamentally, was the ordinary, banal, if you like, plotted fields of southern England, anywhere away from cities and towns, which is where I grew up and lived in. So I wanted to write something about that, the ordinary goodness, as it seemed to me, growing up, of the commonest outside place for me, the commonest outdoor place, which was those somewhat surrendered, man-made bits of England away from the heaped-up towns. And then fields, because at some level they seem to me as somewhere in between what a lot of people are interested in these days. I'm a great admirer of writers like Robert McFarlane on the one hand, and other more contemporary writers who were writing about the kind of urban nature possibilities. There's a wonderful book called Edgelands by Michael Simmons Roberts and Paul Farley, which is about how you can go birdwatching in a container port or in a sewage farm, or how walking down a city street can be an exercise in botany. And Robert's books are marvellous. Robert McFarlane's books are marvellous books about recovering a sense of the wild in the landscape. I wanted to put myself somewhere in between those two books, if you like, somewhere into the back into the ordinary world of the English British countryside, whilst acknowledging that a lot of those fields are kind of hammered to death by agrochemicals and by intensive farming and things like that, but also wanting to say somehow they still feel good to me. I know that bright green that you see is not necessarily a sign of wholesomeness. You know, that means that something's been drenched onto those fields in order to produce this early wheat crop or whatever it might be. But nonetheless, I can't get over the sensation of goodness, I suppose, when encountering those sorts of landscapes. And so that's where I came in. I should say that I'm not a farmer. I haven't got a field of my own. I don't really. I'm scared of cows. I don't really like horses. I don't really like... in fact, the other day I stopped walking across a field because there was a group of cows gathered bulkily around the fence.
Yeah, out to get you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's my apology in a way. I mean, but nonetheless, I do think that people like me who don't have a farming bone in their bodies, you know, I hope will respond in a similar way, or will recognise that something about that landscape, and it's a deeply human landscape. We should be under no illusion that we're looking at nature, really, when we're looking in the fields of Britain. But nonetheless, we'll respond to something of what I've been talking about, this sense of its irresistible goodness, the way in which a field is somehow not... It gives us a chance every year, in a way, as a species, to live in step with the world, you know, to plough, plant, harvest. And that's a wonderful thing, this sense of moving in the world's grain, if you like. But also how a field repeatedly shows us that we go wrong, things don't work. We in order to get the green, we have to drench it in agrochemicals. We're out of step with nature, but at the same time, we have another go next year to get it right. So those four fields speak of that ordinariness to me. There also happen to be fields that are the turning points in their lives. One way or the other, they're fields that have come to some moment where, having been ordinary, they're now on a slightly more wonky, extraordinary journey. The field in Cambridgeshire is a field that, when I first knew it 30 years ago, was growing leeks and potatoes and wheat, and has now been taken out of farming and being returned to swamp, to fenland, by the National Trust as part of this huge project to rewild, to re-wet the fens south of Wicken, between Wicken and Cambridge. An interesting, problematic project in my mind, fantastically exciting in some ways. I just spent early part of this year watching cranes on that field where, you know, 2 years ago there were leeks. Now, fantastic to see that. But nonetheless, not without some issues. I mean, certainly if you're a local farmer who's spent, you know, generations of family toil wresting a living from that soil, that's not necessarily a great way forwards for those fields, those plots. So I like that idea, though. I wanted to explore something about this sense of the field being somewhere that we've clobbered, but which won't ultimately settle.
It is a fascinating subject, but very unusual. I mean, when you went to your agent or your publisher, did they look at you slightly, you know, aghast or puzzled? And did you have to really explain to them how you can do it? Because it is a real mix of sort of memoir, philosophy, ecology. There's so much in there. It's its own category, in a way.
Yeah, maybe too much. Who knows? I felt with this book that I wanted to write everything. You know, it was a sort of book. You know, who knows how many chances you're going to get to write a book. So I stuffed it all in. But as I was thinking about the subject, it became clear that this was a way for me to write about things that are, you know, go far beyond fields, if you like, things that have to do with my own sense of what nature is, my own feeling of how we as a species have occupied the planet, how we've gone wrong with the planet, how we've endured. So, you know, those sorts of things became a way of talking about it as well, I suppose, as well as these particular specific acres. An agent or a publisher they don't really know much about, you know, what happens outside of their offices. In some ways, I mean, they read your proposal, and you know, you hope that you can convince them. But there's another thing going on here, which is about, in a way, our appetite for contact, for connection. I mean, the point of the job of a writer, which picks up some of the things I was saying earlier about a poet looking hard at the world. The job of a writer, it seems to me, is to deliver the reader back to a sense of encounter, especially a writer who's writing about the natural world, whether albeit the humanly modified natural world. And my publishers, I hope, responded to that. Plus, I also, you know, I'm a fancy pants writer. It's lyric compression is what you're getting. And, you know, you don't get many articles about that in Farmers Weekly or in the Nature Conservation Journal. So somewhere between the hard facts of agriculture and the more anxious facts of nature conservation, you know, there ought to be a place for the imagination, if you like, and that's where I hope I fit.
Oh, thank you for that. Well, talking about conservation now, it's probably time to go to the first interview. A couple of weeks ago, I met Anne Shannon. She's the manager of Jane Austen's House Museum in Chawton, Hampshire.
Going around Chawton, it seems to me a very grand house. Would it have been regarded as grand in Jane Austen's time?
No, not at all. It had been a farmhouse. It was the bailiff's house before the Austens came here, and it was the only empty house on Brother Edward's estate. So it wasn't that grand. It had been made comfortable for them, but certainly not grand.
What do you think we can learn from Jane Austen by going around the house that we couldn't learn from her novels?
You can get up close and personal with a few things that we have here. The fact that she sat in that dining room window and wrote at that little table is very personal. And you almost feel the space. The bedroom that she shared with Cassandra, other rooms would have been taken up by family visiting. And there are quite a few things of hers here. It just brings home to people what she'd seen through the window, and it's her place.
It feels a very female house. And there were, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah, there were four women. There was Mrs. Austen, Sister Cassandra, Martha Lloyd, their friend, and obviously Jane.
What do you think it is that fascinates us about Jane Austen? Going around today, it's full of visitors.
Yeah. She remains a bit of an enigma, first and foremost, which is good. But what is fascinating about Jane Austen is, OK, people read her just for the romance. There's wit there, there's wisdom. But I think, really, it's her huge powers of observance of the human condition. Pride and Prejudice, for instance, whose 200th year it is this year, has just about every type of personality, good, bad and indifferent, in it. Her small characters are complete. The truth in those sentences is just as it should be. We are what they were, still. And I think her writing changed the face of the modern novel, and nothing that we read today would be like it is if it hadn't been for Jane Austen writing in the way that she did. And I think all these things come into people, sometimes without them even knowing it. She also adapts extremely well to television.
She shines a light on that particular period of history, as does
this
house.
Yes.
What's the function for you of this house? Is it to illuminate the novels or to just show a little more about the woman?
It's to illuminate both. It's Jane Austen, but also this house and her novels, her writing, her powers. The years I've been here, I came knowing nothing, and now I really and truly believe, after all these years here, that the woman is a genius. There's layer upon layer. I mean, we get people who come in who know absolutely nothing, and if they come out of the house with a smile on their face and think, I've learned a little something, and enjoyed. It's about enjoyment. It's about fun. We have a lot of fun with Jane Austen. She has the wickedest wit.
And what do you think people would be most surprised to learn about her?
That's really difficult because there's so much out there about her, but people may not be aware, but she didn't move in the circle of other writers. She was very isolated from that in a way. I think they'd be surprised to learn that she went further afield than they thought as regard travelling and visiting up to London when her books were being published.
And she lived in a lot of places, but it's at Chawton that she revised her novels for publication.
Yes.
So it's very special.
It is. When she came here, it was quite obvious. This is why her mother, who wanted to do the garden and quilting, gave up the housekeeping. Martha Lloyd and Cassandra took that on. Jane played the piano every day before breakfast, and she was an extremely good pianist. And she then got the breakfast. That was her last duty unless Cassandra and Martha were away. We would not have Jane Austen without Cassandra.
Yeah.
Because she gave her time. She knew the push to write. it was really this huge urge to write out of herself what was in there. And she sat down the minute she came here and revised Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, a certain amount of Northanger Abbey, and then the three complete novels were written here, Mansfield Park, Emma, and then Persuasion.
And actually going around the house, there's a really strong sense of love between the two sisters, which is refreshing because a lot of Austen fans feel quite angry at Cassandra because she burnt all the letters.
We should be grateful to Cassandra that she kept any. I think there's about 167, I may be wrong in that, but there's enough to understand the social times as well. I feel the one she burnt would have been very personal and possibly, as you do between close confidants, said perhaps angry and unkind things about a particular relative who may have annoyed you on the moment.
And what's the most unusual exhibit here, do you think?
That's very hard to tell, really. I think possibly at the moment it's the sword that was presented to Charles Austen. Jane Austen's and Cassandra's, their youngest brother, who they called our own particular little brother. He was in the Navy, he was head of the Navy in the in North American Station, took part in the Battle of Caracas, and was presented a dress sword for the British help by Simon Bolivar. And we've just acquired that. So it's a very unusual exhibit in a house of a woman writer.
Yes.
But had she still been alive, I'm sure she'd have been incredibly proud.
And if you could only show somebody one exhibit, which one would it be?
It'd be that table.
Yeah, that is special, isn't it?
It's very special. We know it was hers. That's where she sat mainly. And it's a very little old table now.
It's tiny.
It's a 12-sided too. Nothing was pretentious here, and we feel that's how it comes over. That's very special.
I noticed on that table that we believe she wrote her novel.
Yes, she did. She may well have used a writing slope if her back were aching. She certainly had a slope when she travelled, so she'd have kept her papers and her pen and ink in there. But we think while she was here, she wrote on that table.
And of course she's been in the news a lot recently because she's now going to be on the £10 note. How do you feel about that?
We're absolutely thrilled. The campaign for women was fine, but when we heard it was Jane, we were absolutely thrilled because, as the Governor of the Bank of England said in his statement here last week, she has endured through the ages. She has accompanied every type of human being through the ages, which is how we feel. She was prescribed to be read to the ill and dying servicemen who were gassed in the First World War, because it was a total opposite to what they were going through. She accompanied Winston Churchill when he was ill in the war. So many different people.
What do you think she would think and say if she could see all these people paying homage to her at her home?
I think she'd be extremely humbled by that. But also, I really do need some peace and quiet to write. Would you mind going away? I mean, she wouldn't have even known that some of these countries existed in her day, let alone people coming from them, people from Brazil, for instance, this morning. I just think she would be honoured and humbled and extremely proud and a little puzzled.
And, of course, one final question. One of her most famous characters, if not the most famous, is Mr. Darcy. Who's your favourite Mr. Darcy?
Colin Firth.
Every time.
Every time, yeah.
And that was Anne Channon from the Jane Austen House Museum in Hampshire. We've got Tim Dee in the studio with us, author of Four Fields. Tim, could you just talk us through the four fields you've chosen and why you chose to write about those?
The first one, as I was saying earlier, is this Cambridgeshire field that I keep on coming back to that's at the bottom of my garden near where I live, on the edge of the Fens now. The other three are foreign fields. The first foreign field is a field in Zambia. My wife, who's is a behavioural ecologist working in the university in Cambridge, has a field site in Zambia, southern Zambia, and she works on a bird called the honey guide, which is a marvellous bird. And it came to seem to me, she doesn't approve of this really since she's a hardcore scientist, but it came to seem to me that this honey guide is a kind of farmer. And so I wanted to write about other ways in which fields and other ways in which landscapes are farmed. The honey guide has this fantastic relationship with people. It's the only bird that has a mutualistic relationship with human beings. It loves to eat beeswax, but it can't get into wild bees' nests, which are in the hollow of a tree trunk. So it calls in a certain way when it finds a person nearby. And if the person recognises the call and calls back to the bird will lead the person through the bush or through the fields to where it's found its bees' nest. And then as it goes, it sort of goes hotter, 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 really hot, boiling hot, as it gets nearer, changing its call. And the deal is the guy, it's normally a man in the bush there with an axe, opens the tree trunk up, takes out honey, which is a wonderful natural source of sugar, and takes most of the honey but leaves a bit of the wax on the comb for the bird. So, and this happened to me. The bird called to me when I was with some local guys in Zambia and followed them through the bush on a farm which was a tobacco farm, farmed by a white colonial farmer who since died, and his farm at the point when I knew it was reverting to bush. So I wanted to write about the end of a field in that sort of way, but also to suggest that there were other ways of farming as carried out by birds like the honey guide. The second foreign field is a battlefield, is the battlefield in Montana in the USA, where Custer was killed by the Sioux and the Cheyenne in 1876, in a battle which it came to seem to me was a battle about what to do with grass, what a field might mean to both either the Native Americans or the Europeans. It was a battle which turned the soil of that place, the prairie, for the first time. Actually, Custer's body and the bodies of the other men from the 7th Cavalry who died there were the first incursions into that soil, the first time that that soil had ever been turned over. So the prairie itself became a cemetery, but also having been a battlefield, it in the future very rapidly became a fenced place, became a farmed place. The Native Americans, as we know, have had a long and ghastly kind of terminal existence ever since then. So that was an important place for me to write about. Of course, writing about Custer is a nightmare because, you know, not only do the Americans obsess about the man and the reasons and the upshot of the death, but also they've written 10,000 books about him. So I needed to find another way of writing about this extraordinary event, and it was to do with this sense of his own body turning the soil there that made me think about quite what that battle had been about. The last field is, in a way, the darkest of all. A reviewer said, as any one joke in my book, I hope it's not a totally dark thing, but it is a dark field, the last field. It's a field in the exclusion zone in Chernobyl around the hinterland of the reactor, which exploded in 1986 and which was evacuated by people, immediately afterwards. So there's a vast area of Ukraine and southern Belarus, which is now empty of people. And I went in there on a special trip with a couple of scientists, remarkable, wonderful, dark men themselves, who've become obsessed with monitoring the effects of radiation on the bird population, particularly swallows. One man, a Danish scientist, he's been going back there since 1991, has ringed more swallows than anybody else has ever done, 50,000 birds he's ringed in his life. So, and looking at those birds, he's discovered all sorts of mutations and aberrations in the population of swallows that breed in Chernobyl. Some people say, including the United Nations and the Ukrainian government, say that taking people out of the exclusion zone around Chernobyl has created a resurgent wilderness. That, you know, you take the people out and nature comes back in. There are wolves and wild horses and things like that. It's true that there are wolves and wild horses, but there are very, very few, and they don't do very well there. Although there aren't any people there, and it ought to become, if it hadn't been poisoned with radiation, which, as we know, in plutonium's case, has a half-life of 23,000 years, so it's got a long time to wait. And my guys, the scientists I went with, are adamant that actually this place is a very, very sick place. So there were fields there, collective farms that had been abandoned, where the fields are now reverting to woodland, but very poisoned woodland, and extraordinary sights of pine trees with naked branches, and then a crazy kind of sea anemone cluster of needles on their fingertips, if you like, making their own wreaths. Very poisoned, very damaged.
Thank you for that. They are a range of fields, and they all sound very different, but what struck me reading the book was the similarities between them and their connection to that original fen field that you talked about. Did you find that, and were you surprised by it?
Yeah, I mean, that's... It was important for me that I'd known those places over a number of years. I'd only been to Chernobyl once, but I'd lived for a time in the 1980s in Eastern Europe and had fallen in love with the flat grasslands of Central Europe. I'd been backwards and forwards to Africa quite a few times and to the Montana battlefield. So I wanted to explore my own changing experiences in those landscapes as well. And I found that actually, picking up what I started off by saying, you know, that fundamentally a walk across a field is for me a good experience. I wanted to test that and explore that and to take that walk into different places, because I know that in a way the reason why I feel is interesting is because it is effectively a reflection of who we are. It's not a wild landscape. It's entirely created by things that we as a species have done to the world, and so that joined all those places together, for better or for worse. I mean, some fields are marvellously enduring. There are still marvellous meadows, and I write about nice fields in this book as well as nasty fields. But I, as a manifestation of our journey on Earth, they seem to me really articulate.
I think it's time for more music now, isn't it? What's the second choice, Alex?
We've got Nick Jones' Little Musgrave.
Should I say something about him?
Could, yeah.
He's a wonderful singer, still alive, had a terrible car crash, and has only just come back to playing after many years away from playing. A fantastic folk singer. This is an ancient story, this, sex with a posh lady, something we've all dreamt of, perhaps. Jane Austen, we've just been listening about. But I love this story, partly because it's a ballad and tells the story incredibly well. He sings it amazingly beautifully. The guitar playing is fantastic. It's also got birds in there. If you listen carefully, the bird song plays a key part in this song.
As it fell out upon a day, as many in the year, Musgrave to the church did go to see fair ladies there. And some came down in red velvet, and some came down in pall, and the last to come down was the Lady Barnard, the fairest of them all. And she's cast a look on the little Musgrave, as bright as the summer sun, and then bethought this little Musgrave, this lady's love I've won. Good day, you handsome youth, God make you safe and free. What would you give this day, Musgrave, to lie one night with me? Oh, I dare not for my lands, lady, I dare not for my life, for the ring on your white finger shows you are Lord Barnard's wife. Lord Barnard's to the hunting gone, and I hope he'll never return, and you shall sleep into his bed and keep his lady warm. There's nothing for to fear, Musgrave, you nothing have to fear. I'll set a page outside the gate to watch till morning clear, and woe be to the little foot page, and an ill death may he die, for he's away to the greenwood as fast as he could fly. And when he came to the wide water, he fell on his belly and swam, and when he came to the other side, he took to his heels and ran. And when he came to the greenwood, 'twas dark as dark can be, and he found Lord Barnard and his men asleep beneath the trees. Arise up, master, he said, arise up and speak to me. Your wife's in bed with a little Musgrave, arise up right speedily. If this be truth you tell to me, then gold shall be your fee. And if it be false you tell to me, then hanged you shall be. Go saddle me the black, he said, go saddle me the grey. And sound you not the horn, said he, lest our coming it would betray. Now there was a man in Lord Barnard's terrain who loved the little Musgrave, and he blew his horn both loud and shrill, away, Musgrave, away. Oh, I think I hear the morning cock, I think I hear the jay, I think I hear Lord Barnard's horn, away, Musgrave, away. Oh, lie still, you little Musgrave, and keep me from the cold. It's nothing but a shepherd boy driving his flock to the fold.
Hey, you,
listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105. We have Tim Dee in the studio with us. And Tim, you're going to read from your book Four Fields for us now. Can you tell us a little, just introduce the piece you're going to read?
Yeah, thank you. This is a passage about the Cambridgeshire field, the key, the heart of this book. And since it's the field which I write about is very near Ely, I wanted to write about eels. Eels, to me, seem like a paradigmatic creature from the fens. They spend half their time crawling across the ground, half their time in the water, which for me is the definition of that landscape. I mean, it's a place that wants to be wet and we've made dry. So this is a bit about eels. Eels, another, of course, Ely means the city of eels, the place of eels. And at one time in the fens, eels were used as a form of currency, as if you could kind of grab together a bunch of eels and pay your bills with them. Fantastic idea. But it's true. Fish silver, it was called. Anyway, this is a little encounter I had with some eels near where I near my field. On the south bank of Burwell Lode, I watched a young man, tattooed and pierced, catching an eel. Like all fish, it seemed to cool the air as it came wet up to it. But like no other fish, it seemed at first to come towards its end, wanting to climb out of the water, twisting on its hook and up the line, refusing to be a fish, and performing some speeded-up account of evolution, or of its own past as a sometime land thing. One silky foot of muscle slalom, a rib of water, an electricity cable shocking itself. I shuddered to remember the country road on the banks of a loch in County Clare, where my fishing life began and ended at the age of 11, with an eel pulled by a worm on a hook from the dark water into the rainy air. And me, terrified by this snake on a string, breathing that same air as I was, and keen, so keen to live, that I couldn't touch it, couldn't still its writhing, couldn't hold it to me to take the hook from its man-mouth, couldn't even cut the line, but instead laid the rod on the road, and as the eel bucked and shimmied like something newly amputated, I picked up a grey breeze block loosed from a jetty, and with both hands launched it onto the fish. Then I first heard that particular sound, the wet, fibrous crunch, which is living bone being broken. With the tip of my boot, I shifted the breeze block. The eel was down, but not out. I needed it dead. There was another breeze block, and then a third, before the thing stopped moving and had lost all of its living shapes and became part of the rain on the road. At the load, I left the eel swimming in the air on its hook and hurried on, asking its fisherman if he would eat it. Only, he said, if I was Polish.
Thank you for that. Oh, we've got so much to talk to you. We're going to come back to you later, but in the meantime, we're going to go to another interview. Alex Mellenby is a former creative writing student at Anglia Ruskin University, and Tregarthe's Promise, his first novel, has just been published. So Tregarthe's Promise, how would you describe the novel?
Well, it's teen fiction. It's an adventure story. Maybe it's a bit like A Mixed Sex, Lord of the Flies, but not quite as literary as Golding. But I think it's an exciting adventure on Dartmoor. I would leave it at that. That's what it is, a teenage adventure story.
So when you picture your reader, you picture a teenager?
Well, not really, because I think, I hope it might have a wider audience, but I would guess that it's mostly teenagers who will read it.
And what attracted you to that genre?
The inspiration for the story was walking on Dartmoor, and I was walking on Dartmoor with a group for the 10 Tours. I don't know if you know about the 10 Tours. It's a challenge over Dartmoor, about 3,000 teenagers walk for 2 days over the moor. And I trained with them, not for very long, because they get very fit and you can't keep up with them. But that sort of inspiration made me feel that it was a young person's place, a place where teenagers can find themselves, can experience the moor. The moor is a very strange and timeless place, and that's the origin of the story.
And the moor is a character, really, in the novel.
Yeah. I mean, if you walk into the middle of Dartmoor, you can't see anything other than the stone circles, the huge rock outcrops, and the weather. And that's really what you see. So I had this feeling every time I did that, that the modern world had disappeared, and here I was in a timeless place. So although I didn't know where I was, because I always got lost, I didn't know when I was, and that's really what was the inspiration for the story.
And the world you've created has things that we recognise in it and things that are as strange and outlandish in it. Was it important to you to create a hybrid, as it were?
Yes. I mean, you're never going to experience that world, and the world obviously doesn't really exist, so it is a hybrid world. And I felt that that made it okay to play around with some of the things in it. So I didn't have to be entirely logical about what I created. That's the attraction of that sort of fiction, that you can put in what you want. Although there are quite a few factual bits which sort of work out.
But you've got some fantastical creatures in there. You've got things called chuckerns and sniffers and stinkers. Where did you get the idea for those?
They just came to me. The chuckerns, I don't want to give away the story, but, I mean, that was the obvious name for them. The sniffers, well, I suppose that when you start writing in that genre, you start to feel that you would call them the things that you would have called them if you'd found them, and that's what I would have called the sniffers if I'd ever found them. So I think I couldn't have got away with another name. That's always going to be like that.
And your protagonist is a teenage boy. Mm. How did you get into the head of a teenage boy? Did you just remember how it had been yourself to be a teenage boy?
Well, I don't think I've really grown up enough to not be a teenage boy, but I think you talk to people, you listen to voices, you hear people talking on the street, you hear people talking all around you, and I guess that's some of it. Obviously, I'm not in the head of a teenage boy, but the inspiration came from really trying to work out how a teenage boy would get away from a load of difficult problems and how they would cope in a completely different situation. He's a difficult teenager, comes from a difficult world. Talking to some of my other writers, and I mean, writing is not exactly a lonely habit. It is when you're actually doing the typing. But you have got all these other writing groups. And certainly two of my writers were commenting on Alvin and said, well, hang on, your character's not right. He'd get bullied, or he is a bully. How are you going to make him not like that? And so I made him come from this weird background. He would get left alone at school because he was really a dangerous character and his family were dangerous. I mean, that helped. That started the story off.
And he's not alone in having problems. There's quite a few of the teenagers in the group who have problems. And was it important to you to include that sort of social realism, really?
Yes. I mean, we all have these problems, and they haunt us throughout our lives. And in your teenage years, they stick with you all the time. Your problems are so huge. I mean, Alvin's problems are huge. Jenna's are as well. And then Sam, with really quite a tragic background, they're with you. You can't escape them. I suppose when you become adult, you've got other problems, and jobs and work. You can't solve your problems as a teenager. They just haunt you. And I wanted Alvin and his group to have an opportunity to sort of take them away from those problems, but give them a whole lot more, which they could then cope with on their own.
And they do go on a journey in the book, don't they? At the end, they're much more mature, they're more resolved about the ways to deal with those problems.
I think so. But having said that, I mean, teenagers are quite mature. I used to be involved in a sex education programme, teaching students in year 9 and 10. And the thing that occurred to me was how mature at that age they really are, how their thought processes are really quite, really very mature. Their views on life are really quite often sometimes much better than adults. And I think, in a way, that sort of made me want to write about them, and it made me want to show how mature they could be in the story.
And this is book one.
Yeah.
How many books are there, and have you plotted them out yet?
Well, yes, I've just sent the publisher book two, and I'm just starting on book three. How many? That depends, I guess, on the publisher and whether people buy them. We're very dependent on that. Teenagers do quite enjoy series, like to follow somebody on, and I've left it quite open at the end of the first book, so there is a problem they need to solve.
And I'm interviewing you here at Anglia Ruskin University, where you did your MA in creative writing. Was that helpful to you?
Oh, the MA is fantastic. I mean, the colleagues I was talking about who helped me with the character of Alvin were students here. So students and the lecturers here. I would never have been able to turn my story into a book unless I'd done the MA at Anglia Ruskin. And it's been wonderful here. It's taken me eight years to write the book. But it's only been since I've been here that I've managed to turn it from some sort of weird collection of words into a story with the reasonable structure.
And you were a GP. Is there any of GP Alex Mullenby in this book?
There's all sorts of different things. I mean, I started off my career in King's College Hospital Casualty, and I made that so famous they've now turned it into a weekly programme. But, I mean, the blood and the gore from there, it's all in the book. And then GP training here in Cambridge back in the 70s. So if you were involved in childbirth from either end, you might have met me. I was usually sent in to make sure the babies cried. Some of that is in there. And the general practice, yeah, there's a bit of that. But most of my career was in public health, which you might spot from some of the things in the book. We're involved in various... I've described it as drain sniffing in the bit about me in the back of the book. It wasn't just drain sniffing. We had a lot of disasters we dealt with, including Litvinenko and the polonium poisoning in London. And those sort of things made me feel in the book I needed to have some quite big disasters. I think they're reasonably large disasters for these teenagers to deal with.
And that was Alex Mellenby, whose first novel, To God Is a Promise, has just been published by Killian Press. In the studio, we've got Tim Dee. Tim, I think almost the first sentence of your book is, throughout my life, much of my happiness has come from being outside. So have you always felt a connection with the natural world?
I think so, although I'm not entirely... I'm not a nature boy. I mean, I was born in the suburbs and grew up in the city. So finding nature was always... a slightly provisional thing. It happened between the cracks in the pavements and in the back gardens and things. And there was a nature table at school, and all those sorts of things were important to me. I put out nest boxes and fed the garden birds. So much like ordinary, you know, everybody does. A lot of children join organisations like the Young Ornithologist Club or whatever it's now called, Bird Life Explorers or something. For me, I kept it going. I became a kind of hardcore twitcher for a period in my teenage years, to my shame, in a way. To my shame, because actually when you realise what you're chasing after, which are very rare birds that have been blown around the world and swept up into the British Isles as casualties, they're almost all of them at death's door. You know, these are birds that have gone wrong one way or the other. And incredibly exciting to see an American bird in Britain was a heart-stopping occasion. Likewise, seeing birds from Siberia, often on the same day, you know, to meet the world gathered together in a Norfolk wood in that way, albeit in the company of men with beards and greasy coats, and then having to spend the night sleeping in ladies' toilets on the North Norfolk coast. Ladies' toilets because they're drier than gents to sleep on the floor of. So I was a kind of hardcore bird watcher in that way, interested in collecting, listing the usual slightly indicative ways of which men in a state of arrested development go about their lives. Then I kind of grew up and retired from that sort of bird watching. But it's always been incredibly important to me. But it's always been in parallel for me with language, with words. You know, birds and words have been my thing. I studied English at university rather than science. I'm not a professional scientist. My understanding of science is ropey at best. I'm married to a scientist who puts me right on things, but that's it. So nature for me has always been a wonderful meeting of both things beyond language, things that, you know, that don't need language, will have their own language that we don't really understand, you know, birds, flowers, animals, whatever it might be, landscapes, and our encounter with that, the wild world, the natural world, and the way we brought it to us by bringing it into language.
You preempted a question I was about to ask, actually, which is why you didn't take the science route, because it's sort of all things almost pointed to that when you were younger and you were, you know, not obsessed, but, you know, into your birds, and you ended up taking the arts route. Why do you think that is?
Well, partly because I couldn't do maths and I couldn't do physics. Yeah. I mean, I did love biology, and but I wasn't allowed to study it on its own. I think that might be different nowadays. Maybe you can. So I think it was that. But also I felt that, in some ways, I love the kind of austere poetry of the field guide, of the list of birds, you know, that just the name of the species written down one after the other. I also loved the kind of grapple that we as a species had made with those species, the way in which we'd got them wrong, we'd misnamed them at times. We imagined them to be birds carrying souls. We imagined them to be migrating to the moon, all those sorts of things that you discover from reading poetry and early myths and things like that, Aesop's fables. I loved the way in which the natural world had pushed its way into our world, and principally through the imagination rather than through the sciences. And, you know, the imagination predated the sciences in that way.
I think it's time for your last piece of music now. It's Bob Dylan, Abandoned Love. Why did you choose this?
Well, this is a rarity. It's been released only as on a sort of semi-official bootleg. It comes from this golden period of Dylan's career between kind of Blood on the Tracks and Desire. It's got him being his sort of funny, I'm a hopeless misogynist, but I'm also deeply in love with women thing that is sort of appealing and ghastly at the same time. I think it's just a sublime piece of music.
My heart is telling me I love you still. Turning out the key, I've been deceived by the clown inside of me. I thought that he was a righteous, but he's a vain. Well, something's telling me I'll wear the ball and chain. My patron saint is fighting with a ghost. He's always up somewhere.
Bob Dylan there, and you're listening to Bookmark. We have Tim Z in the studio. Tim, there's a little bit of time left. I wonder if you could tell us about your first book, which is called The Running Sky.
Well, that was an attempt to write about birds and my birdwatching life. I mean, it did pick up on the rough sleeping in North Norfolk ladies' toilets a little bit. And it was a book that sort of pushed its way forward to me. I kept on talking about my bird obsession to various people, friends of mine and my family, who eventually said, you better just write this down, for goodness sake, and shut up. And it came at a time, and it was published at a time when a lot of people were seeking a kind of writing and maybe reconnecting with it, with a certain sort of nature writing, countryside writing, that sort of thing. For me, it was important that I'd accumulated years and years of life, of looking without necessarily thinking about writing. I used to keep notebooks and diaries. That was my nature writing for a long, long time.
I was going to ask you how you remember, because that is the thing that puzzles me.
Yeah, so. Well, a lot of those experiences were very vividly blasted into my mind as well, because they were intense feelings. You know, there's intense moments in strange places, sewage farms, reservoirs, blasted headlands and things like that, and looking for birds who were also having intense experiences at that time, you know, being blown across the place. And I got into the habit early on, which is what everyone was told in those days, you know, write it all down, write, you know, keep notes of the birds you see. And somehow the writing, just a simple, bald list of species, was able to sort of stow them in my mind for me.
Was that all factual kind of notes?
Yeah, I never...
There was never any...
I never really wrote a haiku at the end of my day. Although I would come home and read Ted Hughes or that wonderful writer J.A. Baker's book, The Peregrine, which was absolutely incredibly important to me as a young man, a book which you can't really tell whether it's a novel or a piece of nature writing, about watching peregrines in the winter in Essex. Fantastic writing.
But does writing it down spoil it in a way? When you go for a walk, are you thinking about metaphors and how you'll transfer that to paper?
That's a good question. I mean, it's important to absorb those experiences, and it's important to remember them for all sorts of reasons, not necessarily just for writing them down at the end of the day or hoping to turn them into a piece of polished prose. I love the writing. I love the engagement with the world that comes through writing, which is another form of interrogation in a way. You're looking hard down a pair of binoculars, bringing things closer to you through the magnified lenses. Writing is not dissimilar in some ways. It's about reaching out and trying to find an equivalence.
Your vocabulary and your descriptions are so rich in the book. What puts me and maybe other people off landscape writing to do it rather than to read it is that I think I would just run out of words after a while.
A tree.
Where does this come from, all these images and textures that you put into your work?
Well, I spend my professional life as a radio producer. I work a lot with writers. I'm not in the Natural History Unit at the BBC. I make radio plays and do poetry programmes. So I spend a lot of time talking to people who've got even bigger vocabularies than me, if you like, and even finer ones, fancier ones. And reading, you know, reading's always important. And trying to find some version of language to make it new, as you have to try to do, but nonetheless to make it familiar at the same time. I write down lists of words. I mean, sometimes it's too much, perhaps. Some people might find it overdone. I know people have said that. But then it's true to me. You know, I test my language against the experience every time.
And what's your next project?
Well, I'm trying not to write a book at the moment because I've spent too many years only writing books and being a radio person. But I'm holding off, but not very successfully at the moment. I want to write a book about following the spring through Europe, walking at the same speed as the spring comes.
And have you thought about writing a novel in any way?
No. I mean, I love lyrical writing, but I can't do dialogue or character. I'm too maybe selfish. Who knows what it is? But and in a way, because I've spent so much time writing about things that don't speak, I think that's where I live. I live with the unspoken world, the landscape, nature, and that's the conversation I'm having is me and it, rather than populating a book with other people's voices. And I mean, I love novels, read lots of novels, and you know, fiction is incredibly important to me. I've written a lot in this book about Tolstoy. Who managed to take his nature writing into his nature thinking and nature writing into his novel writing wonderfully in Anna Karenina. I mean, if you gather a list of haymaking writers in this book, and there are lots of them, a lot of writers interested in that same sort of thing, but it's not for me as a fictional project.
And I think probably your writing is closer to poetry in that, and perhaps as a writer you are more in line with that. And you've done a poetry book or edited one called The Poetry of Birds.
Yes, and I'm not a poet. My metrics are appalling. You know, I don't know how to make a line scan, but I do read a lot of poetry and I hang around with poets in that slightly dubious company. and that book is an anthology of bird poetry, and it brings us back right back to where we started. Actually, it's hard to find a poet in Britain writing in English who hasn't written a poem about a bird. It's amazingly close, the looking at nature and bringing the nature into poetry.
Arguably, you could write a sequel, actually, to Four Fields, couldn't you? You could go back in 10 years' time and see where those fields are.
Yeah, and they are all at changing points in their lives. And they're, with luck, the one in Cambridgeshire will be an extraordinary wetland that will be exciting and give us some intimation of the world that we've lost across the wider fens.
Well, thank you so much, Tim, for coming into the studio. It's been great chatting with you. Our next programme, our next bookmark, we've got Angela Clark, author of The Very Funny Confessions of a Fashionista. She's going to be our studio guest. And we'll have interviews with the curator at Wising Arts about their new exhibition on books and bookshops. And you'll also be chatting...
I'll be talking to the romantic novelist, Sue Moorcroft, who's written dozens of books, all fun romantic romps. So we'll be talking to her.
Fantastic. And we should say, please don't forget Cambridge Winter Word Fest, which is on the 1st of December. There are writers coming to the city such as Lionel Shriver, Margaret Drabble, Jonathan Coe and Sarah Dunant, who we're hoping to interview for this show. And you can find out more about that at their website, www.cambridgewordfest.co.uk, where you can get a full programme and also buy tickets.
And do get in touch with us here at the programme as well. If you've got any questions for us or for our guests, that's www.cambridge105.fm.
Or if you know a writer you think would like to appear on the show, we're willing to talk to anyone, aren't we?
Pretty much.
So until our next show, enjoy your books.